Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Did you know you can get Democracy Now!'s headlines and stories delivered directly to your inbox every day? Just text Democracy Now!, one word, no space. Text Democracy Now! To 66866 to subscribe to our daily digest, and you'll never miss a story. Once again, Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. Thanks so much, and stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We live in constant struggle for the truth, and we live in constant struggle in remaking America in its image of freedom and liberty for all. Not the image of the past, but the image of what the future of America should look like.
As the CDC issues a new 60-day eviction moratorium, we'll speak to Congressmember Ilhan Omar, who camped out on the steps of the U.S. Capitol overnight Friday to pressure the Biden administration to take action. We'll talk to her about housing, the recent U.S. airstrikes on her home country of Somalia, plus her memoir, This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman. We'll also hear from a Kansas City tenant who faces eviction.
I actually have my dad's ashes, and one of my big concerns is, you know, if I get kicked out on the street, like, what am I going to do with my dad's ashes?
And we go to Lebanon, where security forces fired water cannons and tear gas at protesters, marking 1 year since the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut that killed hundreds and displaced thousands. Human Rights Watch is accusing senior Lebanese officials of failing to protect the public.
Culpability for the explosion still rests with those officials who knew the ammonium nitrate was being stored at the port in an unconscionable and dangerous manner, and failed to do what was within their authority and under their responsibility to secure or remove it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Health Organization is calling on wealthy countries to halt plans to provide a third booster shot of COVID-19 vaccines to some citizens until at least 10% of the population of every country is vaccinated. The call from WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus came Wednesday as the number of confirmed coronavirus cases worldwide topped 200 million.
We cannot and we should not accept countries that have already used most of the global supply of vaccines, using even more of it, while the world's most vulnerable people remain unprotected.
The WHO's call was quickly rebuffed by the Biden administration. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters the U.S. would provide a third booster shot to people at higher risk of COVID-19 if the FDA decides such shots are warranted. The producers of some of the world's most effective COVID-19 vaccines continue to raise prices on the life-saving inoculations, with Pfizer and Moderna set to charge the European Union more than $23 and $25 per dose, respectively. A recent study by the People's Vaccine Alliance found Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna are charging governments as much as $41 billion above the estimated cost of production. Globally, coronavirus cases are continuing to rise, fueled by the spread of the Delta variant. China's ordered mass testing in Wuhan, the first epicenter of the pandemic, and suspended travel and public events across much of the country. China's confirmed new cases in at least three dozen cities and more than half its provinces. Thailand reported another record for daily infections with over 20,000 new cases Wednesday. In Japan, the Tokyo Olympics organizing body reported yet another daily record for infections, with 31 more positive tests reported Thursday among people associated with the Games. COVID-19 cases continue their exponential rise in the United States, with unvaccinated people accounting for nearly all hospitalizations and deaths. In Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker has ordered a mask mandate for all students, teachers, and staffers during the upcoming school year. In Arkansas, one of this country's worst hit states, Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson said Wednesday he regrets signing a bill banning local mask mandates and now wants the law reversed.
Yes, in hindsight, I wish that had not become law. But it is the law, and the only chance we have is either to amend it or for the courts to say that it has an unconstitutional foundation.
Florida continues to set new records for hospitalizations and deaths, accounting for about 1 in 5 U.S. COVID-19 cases. Despite that, the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, has threatened to withhold funds to school districts that defy his ban on mask mandates and other health measures. On Wednesday, DeSantis blamed immigrants and President Biden for Florida's COVID surge.
So why don't you do your job? Why don't you get this border secure? And until you do that, I don't want to hear a blip about COVID from you.
At least 4 Florida school districts have moved to flout Governor DeSantis's statewide ban on mask mandates. But Broward County said Wednesday it was reversing its mask mandate under pressure from the governor. This is Broward County Mayor Stephen Geller speaking Monday.
Unfortunately, Dade and Broward County lead the nation in new hospitalizations. The numbers are doubling every 10 or 11 days. Geometric progression. This is horrifying.
The Florida governor is threatening to withhold state funds from schools that impose mask mandates, as is the governor of Texas. In Houston, Mayor Sylvester Turner has renewed a mask order for city employees, defying a Texas ban on mask mandates. Republican Governor Greg Abbott has threatened to defund schools that require masks. Meanwhile, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is expected to soon seek a presidential waiver to make COVID-19 vaccines mandatory for all active duty soldiers. Landlords in Georgia and Alabama have asked a federal judge to block the Biden administration's new 2-month moratorium on evictions. The new CDC moratorium covers areas of the United States where there's substantial or high spread of the coronavirus. The Alabama and Georgia chapters of the National Association of Realtors filed their motion with U.S. District Judge Dabney Frederick, a Trump appointee who ruled in favor of landlords in May. We'll have more on this story after headlines with Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Protests in Lebanon Thursday marked the first anniversary of one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history, the Beirut port explosion that killed at least 218 people, injured 7,000, and destroyed or damaged 300,000 homes. So far, no one's in the political leadership that has been held accountable for leaving over 2,700 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer unattended at Beirut's port. This is Leah Noon, who lost her brother to the explosion. She was among the protesters who held a protest and vigil at the site of the blast.
We all came on this sad day to an uprising, not a memorial. We all came with burnt hearts for our martyrs and heroes who died as victims. My cousin is Joe Noon, who stood at warehouse number 12 and was opening the door as the explosion took place. They promised us a 5-day investigation, and this is not the 5th day. This is day 365, and still nothing has come from the investigation.
This comes amidst an economic collapse and political crisis that's largely left Lebanon without a functioning government. We'll have the latest on Lebanon's crisis going to Beirut later in the broadcast. Israel's military says it fired artillery shells into southern Lebanon and later carried out airstrikes after Lebanese militants fired rockets into northern Israel. The fighting sparked large brush fires along the border. Meanwhile, in northern Lebanon, crews battled wildfires for a third straight day as the blazes spread into Syria. Elsewhere in the Mediterranean region, Turkey's been hit by its most intense fires on record, with one blaze breaching a coal-fired power plant overnight in southwestern Turkey. Large swaths of Greece and Albania face very poor air quality amidst a searing heat wave fueled by the climate crisis, with wildfires kicking up huge quantities of fine particulate matter. In California, the fast-growing Dixie Fire engulfed the Northern California community of Greenville overnight, leveling its downtown area. In Russia, record wildfires in the Siberian region of Yakutia have set an all-time emissions record equivalent to more than 500 megatons of carbon dioxide. Mexico's government has filed a landmark lawsuit in a federal court in Massachusetts seeking to hold 10 U.S.-based firearms companies accountable for Mexico's epidemic of gun violence. Gun manufacturers named in the suit include Smith & Wesson, Colt, and Glock. It's the first time U.S. gun makers have been sued by a foreign government. The Mexican foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, announced the lawsuit Wednesday.
The companies named in the lawsuit should provide compensation to Mexico for the damages caused by their negligent practices. The amount in this case will be determined by the judge.
Over 300,000 people have been killed since Mexico launched its U.S.-backed war on drugs in 2006. The Belarusian athlete Kristina Szymanowska has landed in Poland, where she's requesting political asylum. Last weekend, the sprinter refused orders from the Belarus Olympic delegation to leave the Games in Tokyo and return to Belarus after she criticized her coaches. Polish officials granted her a humanitarian visa, agreeing she would face harsh punishment under the authoritarian government of Alexander Lukashenko. The United States healthcare system once again ranks dead last among wealthy countries. That's according to a new report by the Commonwealth Fund. Researchers found the U.S. spends far more per capita than 10 other nations: Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Holland, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the U.K., yet has the lowest life expectancy, highest infant and maternal mortality rates, and the most glaring inequities. Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal responded, quote, "Our cruel for-profit health care system is broken. It's time to guarantee health care as a human right. It's time for Medicare for all," she said. In sports news, a new report finds the National Collegiate Athletic Association has consistently treated women's sports as inferior to men's, with stark gender-based differences in the goods, services and resources provided to competitors in March Madness basketball tournaments. An outside review commissioned by the NCAA recommends a number of reforms, including a combined men's and women's Final Four tournament. And here in New York, at least four district attorneys have launched criminal probes into findings of sexual harassment by Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo. Prosecutors in Westchester, Nassau, Manhattan, and Albany have requested additional information from the office of New York Attorney General Letitia James after her civil probe found Cuomo harassed at least 11 women in violation of the law, including unwanted touching and kissing and inappropriate remarks. Democrats in the New York State Assembly said Wednesday they have enough votes to impeach Governor Cuomo. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki reiterated President Biden's call for Cuomo to resign.
Because of the abhorrent allegations that were made public yesterday, that it is time for Governor Cuomo to resign. Obviously, if leadership changes in the state, we will work with a different leader.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the fight over housing. Landlords in Georgia and Alabama have asked a federal judge to block the Biden administration's new two-month moratorium on evictions. The new CDC moratorium covers areas of the United States where there's substantial or high spread of the coronavirus, about 90% of the country. The Alabama and Georgia chapters of the National Association of Realtors filed its motion with U.S. District Judge Dabney Friedrich, a Trump appointee who ruled in favor of landlords in May. A nationwide moratorium on evictions expired Saturday after Democratic lawmakers failed to pass a bill to protect millions of people who could be forced from their homes. The White House initially said the moratorium could only be extended by Congress due to a recent Supreme Court ruling, but the Biden administration reversed course following intense pressure from progressive lawmakers. On Friday night, three members of Congress, Cori Bush of Missouri, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, camped outside the U.S. Capitol with others to demand action. Congressmember Ilhan Omar joins us now. She's just published the paperback version of her memoir. It's titled, "This is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman." It tells the story of how she became the first Somali American and one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. Representative Ilhan Omar, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your book is called This this is what America looks like. And I think of that picture of you on the steps of the Capitol, sleeping out with Cori Bush and Ayanna Pressley, two other congresswomen of color, demanding that millions of people not be thrown out of their homes, demanding of your own colleagues and the Biden administration. Congratulations on the release of your paperback. Talk about why you stayed out overnight.
Well, Amy, it's really great to be with you this morning. I remember seeing Cori put out a message to us to join her. And I, you know, thought it was really important for us to express just how important it was for people to realize as lawmakers, we have a responsibility to protect those that sent us to legislate on their behalf. And, you know, as Cori has her own personal experience with being, unhoused, I certainly have experienced severe aspects of that as someone who not only slept on the side of roads, on beaches, as you have read probably in my book, but also spent a lot of time in a refugee camp, in destitute. And so, you know, my own experiences, her own experiences, Ayanna's own experiences with dealing with homelessness has pushed us to take that drastic measure. And we knew that it would ultimately, motivate our colleagues and the White House to take action. They could no longer ignore the kind of devastation that inaction would have caused in our country.
So you're taking on your own party, along with taking on the opposing party, the Republican Party. Just inside, your colleagues had just gone on recess. Now, while the Biden administration, responding to your pressure, enormous pressure, just not exactly reinstated the moratorium, but did a slightly modified one where it'll cover 90% of the country and cited the CDC, you know, the CDC imposed it. But they had said, Biden had said, it's really up to Congress because the Supreme Court struck this down already. Why? How is it possible that the House, that's Democrat-led, could not pass an extension of the moratorium?
This is what has been the most frustrating part of this whole conversation. You know, we obviously didn't have a lot of time. That's understood. We got the notification on Thursday and we, rushed to produce legislation with the leadership of Chairwoman Waters. And we believed it was important to stay over the weekend, negotiate and have the ability to vote on the bill. We believed that people should be on the record voting on a yes or no on whether 11 million people possibly should be facing eviction. And then they should be forced to go to their constituents and explain why they made their decisions. And the fact that leadership decided to not do that, to not take that route, was frustrating, not just for me, but even for Chairwoman Waters, who certainly thought it was really important for us to take a vote on the bill that she produced. The thing that most people find really confusing about this whole thing is that we would choose to go on recess and prioritize our time when the people who sent us desperately needed us to act. And, you know, I always said it's really important for us to send people who have fluency in the day-to-day struggles of their constituents. And this was very evident on how important that is.
And just to understand, when you're saying you only got notice on Thursday, explain what you mean by that for people who can't understand how this went down at the last minute. You got notice from the Biden administration that they weren't going to extend it?
Yes, we've been communicating since May, even earlier than that, with the administration and saying, you know, we need you all to expand the eviction moratorium. People are going to be at risk. The money that we appropriated to help renters and landlords isn't going out as fast as it should be. Municipalities and states need more time, and we need you all to take action. And it wasn't until Thursday that they affirmatively told us that it was going to be up to Congress to create that expansion. They weren't going to do it themselves. And then, you know, it was a rush in the House to try to figure out what we could do and how fast that legislation could be put together. I remember being pulled aside by Chairwoman Waters in the middle of one of those votes and saying, you know, we're going to put this bill on the floor. Talk to your colleagues, Chairwoman Chaiapol from the Progressive Caucus. Asked, you know, if we can pull together an emergency meeting. As you know, I serve as the whip of the Progressive Caucus to gauge where we will be at. And a lot of us, you know, dispatched and started having conversations with our colleagues, even some moderate Democrats, to say, what do you need in order for you to be able to be with us in protecting 11 million people across this country from being evicted? And as those conversations were taking place throughout Friday, it was our understanding that those conversations would continue, that we would legislate and that we would protect these 11 million people. And we were shocked when we saw that leadership decided to seek unanimous consent and was not going to bring the bill to the floor for a vote, and that some of our colleagues were leaving and they were choosing to also not leave their proxy votes because, you know, during the pandemic, we've been able to have the ability to vote without being physically at the Capitol. And the fact that they weren't willing to leave their proxy votes with people so that we could actually pass legislation was alarming to us and, you know, very shameful.
And can you explain Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib's call on House Democrats to return recent contributions from real estate tycoon George Marcus, who recently donated $1 million to the House Majority PAC just weeks before the Democratic lawmakers failed to extend the eviction moratorium, who he is?
These sort of really clear conflicts of interests for legislators is something that we should be having a broader conversation. I was shocked when I saw the reporting. I think it's really important for there not to be a doubt on behalf of the people that we are there representing them and that we're going to do everything that is going to help them. And the fact that, you know, there was a rush to leave and not do anything on expanding the eviction moratorium until that drastic measure was taken by us choosing to sleep on the Capitol steps is really not sitting well with so many people. I remember getting a lot of calls from my constituents if those were linked. And, you know, I joined Rashida in that call because we have to get rid of, you know, any semblance of conflict of interest.
So also, if you can explain what you have introduced, the Rent and Mortgage Cancellation Act. I mean, the fact is that even if there's a moratorium, isn't it true that afterwards people who can't afford to pay their monthly rent will have to pay it all back?
Well, the problem right now that we are seeing is that, you know, we allocated billions of dollars to these municipalities and to states. And that money is taking so long to get out the door. With my legislation, we would have automatically canceled rent and landlords would have had the ability to get those resources themselves. And it would have reduced the amount of money that is being utilized for administrative cost. The backlog and the slow process that we are seeing right now is due to the fact that there are, in some cases, you know, pages and pages long paperwork that people have to do. And there are a lot of people who still are not aware that they can access this money. And I thought, you know, oftentimes we create policy that creates more problems than addressing the actual issue. And, you know, having direct legislation that provides direct solution, like the Cancel Rent and Mortgage Act, is really important.
I wanted to switch gears and talk about something else that has been happening. The U.S. military recently conducted at least three drone strikes in your home country of Somalia. In the first attacks, they said targeting al-Shabaab fighters in Somalia since President Biden took office. Congressmember Omar, your family came to the U.S. as Somali refugees. You wrote a letter to President Biden requesting more information on these strikes. You said, quote, "It's critical that any military action must be part of a broader strategy focused on the security of the Somali people and the stability of the Somali state." Can you talk about what you understand why the U.S. bombed Somalia again?
So it's been really hard to get any concrete information that is really answers any of the questions I put in to my letter. It was our understanding that this administration was going to take a step back. They were going to look at a holistic approach. They were going to reassess their drone program and their engagement with Somalia. And the fact that they just started up the drone program without doing any of those things and without communicating any of those things to us as members of Congress was really alarming. I mean, Somalia has faced instability. You know, I fled civil war in the early 90s. And to this day, you know, there is places in Somalia where it is still unsafe for people to live in. You know, al-Shabaab has and terrorism in Somalia has caused lots of devastation. And it is abhorrent for them to continue to operate. And so I do, you know, stand with the Somali government and our administration in fighting al-Shabaab. What I do not appreciate is for us to not have a holistic approach to both fighting al-Shabaab and creating stability and having policies that are going to create a long-term stable Somalia.
So speaking of Somalia, in your book, you so eloquently talk about your growing up, your first 8 years in Somalia. Talk about Somalia. Tell us, you know more than anyone being in Congress, how little information most people understand about Africa unless they are from there. And then particularly Somalia, why you left, your experience as a refugee, which so informs what you do now working on immigration rights. Talk about your family.
Well, my story is uniquely an American story, right? We have been known as a country of immigrants. There has been the arrival of immigrants for a really long time from different parts of the world. But we are now just seeing, you know, Somali immigrants, and there's a lot that is not understood. And I thought it was really important for me to write this book and spend a lot of time telling people about the Somalia I grew up in, where, you know, there was a lot of warmth. I had a really happy upbringing up to the age of 8. I grew up in a very loud, loving family where, you know, we didn't really have any ideas of hierarchy. We were all allowed to have the freedom to express ourselves, to own our agency. And, you know, I grew up in a household and in a community where music and the arts and all of those things were very vibrant. And, you know, the tragedy of living in that and then one day waking up and having, you know, the kids that you played with in the streets now carry guns is something that most people don't know. And I wanted to give people an insight of what happens when a society is stable and, you know, is not really nurturing that stability, how everything can disappear in a day, and how, you know, someone who had that happy upbringing finds herself in a refugee camp, missing, you know, 4 years of formal education, coming to the United States, getting that golden ticket and opportunity, and, you know, overcoming a lot of the challenges that continue to exist in this country for people who arrive without nothing, and what it means to now have that voice in Congress, bringing attention to all of those disparities that exist here and in countries like Somalia.
And if you could talk about, if you could respond to what's happening now on the African continent as it relates to COVID. Our first headline today is about the desperate plea of the World Health Organization head saying there should not be, you know, third shot boosters in the wealthiest countries in the world before 10% of all countries are vaccinated. We've talked several times to the head of the African CDC. If you can talk about the situation in Somalia as well, and whether you support Ghebreyesus's call, something that Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, said, if the FDA says we need third shot boosters, we'll go for them.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, when COVID began, there was a call to social distance. And I remember thinking about Somalia and other countries in Africa where social distancing would be a luxury, right? These are places that are sometimes overpopulated, where there are open markets, where people, you know, don't have a lot of space to distance in the ways that it was being recommended. And they have fragile healthcare systems. There is lots of poverty. There is a lot of insecurity in all aspects of life. Many of these governments don't have the resources that that it takes to be able to keep everyone safe. As you know, we've struggled here in the United States, and we are one of the countries that has the most resources in the world. And so I do think it is really important for us to recognize that, you know, our humanity is tied to one another. And, you know, as I waited to get vaccinated because I thought it was important to have other people who were at risk be vaccinated before me, I'm finally vaccinated. My whole family is vaccinated here. But I do often think about my family in Somalia and what it means for them to have access to that vaccination. You know, we led a global call to send vaccinations to countries like Somalia and other countries in Africa and around the world that desperately need these resources. And so I do hope that before we think about giving ourselves a boost, that we send those resources to people who are less fortunate than we are.
Let me ask you about the issue of refugees, your experience, and immigrant justice in the United States. Groups are now suing the Biden administration over its use of Title 42, that Trump-era policy that allows for the expedited deportation of asylum seekers arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, citing so-called public health concerns during the pandemic. The Biden administration says it'll continue enforcing the policy, which could bar entry to hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers. Human Rights Watch says over 600,000 have been expelled from the U.S. under Title 42 since March of 2020, you know, going back through Trump. The lawsuit was filed by the ACLU, RAISIS, and Oxfam, among other groups, which denounced Title 42 as cruel, illegal, and a violation of due process rights. Your thoughts, Congressmember Omar?
I think these, you know, Trump-era policies that the administration chooses to keep in place are inhumane on a deep personal level. I got emotional just thinking about this right now because a lot of the people that come to our border are, you know, escaping desperate situations. And it's easy for people to judge. It's easy for people to, you know, talk about what makes somebody come to the border until they find themselves there. And I think a lot about what would have happened if Kenya closed its borders to my family when we were fleeing and or chose to deport us back. Where would I have been today? And so for me, it is really important for this administration and for every single person in this country to realize that these policy choices have consequences. And, you know, we have a moral imperative in this country to get our immigration policy right and make it a more humane system. We have the Citizenship Act, you know, that we have been pushing for in Congress that would stabilize the status of 11 million people in this country. We have been working so hard to try to come up with actual solutions to our immigration crisis. And it is disheartening that instead of people working with us to find a solution, that they do the easy thing that sometimes seems might win you political favor, might stop some headlines from being written, but, you know, chip away at your soul, knowing that you are turning people away who desperately need help and are coming to this country, knowing that we have been a country that welcomes people and provides opportunities for people.
I choked up reading your book, a part where you're in the refugee camp and you lose your beloved aunt. Was her name pronounced Foss? Can you tell us about her? And this goes to people waiting in refugee camps, waiting and waiting, and the devastating toll it can take.
Yeah. You know, I think a part of my story that most people don't know, which has made me a really strong advocate for a lot of the young people who are coming, and has made me speak out in regards to family separation, is that I was separated from most of my family. My Aunt Foss was the one who, you know, was who brought me and three of my siblings along with us on that journey to escape Mogadishu as war raged on. And she was my everything. You know, I owed my life to her. And life in a refugee camp is not an easy one. In the refugee camp Utanga that we were living in, malaria was devastating the camp and taking lives. And she ended up getting malaria and ended up losing her life. And, you know, there was no healthcare that we could provide for her. There was no way to save her life, and just to watch helplessly. And know that she wasn't going to make it, but to not just like live with the fact that we were losing her, that she wasn't going to live anymore, but that we were losing someone who really our survival depended on in so many ways, was very hard. And writing, you know, those chapters were very hard. Doing the audio tape for those chapters was very hard. Doing this interview is very hard, but it's not as hard as what people have still been experiencing. There are a lot of young people who I lived in that refugee camp with, who didn't get the opportunity to stabilize their lives. They, once that camp closed, they were sent to another camp. And I went in 2011 when drought was devastating Somalia and over a million people were at risk of dying from famine to Dadaab refugee camp, which is one of the largest refugee camps in Africa, if not in the world. And I saw some of the young people that I was in the camp with, some of the kids I played with, who were also adults and had children themselves in those camps, as I've had opportunities to fulfill my education and now become a member of Congress. And so I feel like I owe it to those people to speak up about the plight of refugees around the world, to seek justice for people who have experienced war, who haven't experienced a remedy, not just for their trauma, but everything that they have lost, and for people who are in this country who just want to have their humanity seen and want to be treated with dignity.
Congressmember Omar, speaking of the horror of losing lives unnecessarily. I wanted to pivot to your home state and to your city, Minneapolis, where police killed George Floyd, murdered him, prompting mass protests. Now local activists have gathered more than 22,000 signatures to place a measure on the ballot this November to vote on whether to abolish the city's police department and replace it with a new Department of Public Safety. But the city attached an explanatory note to the ballot initiative that organizers say is misleading, partial description. They filed a lawsuit to stop the note from being placed on the ballot initiative, saying the city's trying to influence voters with subjective, selective language. You are one of the leaders of this community that has experienced so much trauma. Can you talk about your views on this and what you think would lead to a more just solution, not only in Minneapolis, but it is certainly a model for the whole country?
Yeah, well, first of all, in regards to the ballot measure and to the tactics of those that want to keep the status quo in place. I say to them, you know, we've dealt with that before in Minnesota in regards to ballot measures, and I believe that this one will also be met with the same fate as the other one. So I'm confident that we will prevail. We've had a very incompetent and brutal police department for a really long time, and you know, to the rest of the country and the world, they saw what happened with George Floyd and might have thought this is a one-off situation. I remember witnessing my first police shooting as a teenager, where they put nearly 38 bullets into the body of a mentally ill man who was just released from an institution, who didn't speak a word of English, who couldn't respond to their commands, who was not of any imminent threat to have had his life taken in such a brutal and a shameful way. And so many of us have experienced those kind of killings in front of civilians far too often than we would like to have seen. So the fact that the Minneapolis Police Department can no longer exist the way it is one that is understood by the majority of us. And I believe in the fight that people have engaged in regards to trying to have a more just system for us, and we'll continue to support their effort.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Congressmember Ilhan Omar, Minnesota Congressmember representing the 5th Congressional District. From Mogadishu to Minneapolis, the paperback edition of her memoir has just been released. It's titled, This is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman. Thanks so much, Congressmember Omar. Well, up next, we go to Lebanon, where security forces fired water cannons and tear gas at protesters, marking 1 year since the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut, killing hundreds, injuring thousands. Stay with us. When Doves Cry by Prince. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Security forces in Lebanon fired water cannons and tear gas at protesters, marking 1 year since the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut that killed 218 people, injured 7,000, destroyed or damaged 300,000 homes, one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. But so far, no one in the political leadership has been held accountable for leaving over 2,700 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer unattended at Beirut's port. This comes as a new report by Human Rights Watch implicates senior Lebanese officials for failing to protect the public. This is Paul Naguir, who spoke this week about how his 3-year-old daughter, Alexandra, was at home with her mother, Tracy, when they heard the blast. Tracy tried to shield Alexandra, but a shockwave from the explosion forced them across the room. They were knocked unconscious. Her husband, Paul, came home to find them badly injured and unconscious, but alive. Their daughter died days later in the hospital. He said officials should have done more to prevent her death.
They had 40 minutes and they did not react. I want to try to put myself in the shoes of Michel Aoun, for instance, and just taking an example. What was he thinking at this time? So he's sitting at home, you know, or in his palace, turned on the TV and looks at smoke coming out of the harbor. He's a past brigadier in the army, specializes in weaponry. And he looks at the and he looks at these images. He's the president of the country and supposedly the father of all, Bay al-Kil, as they call it in Arabic. What does a human being think when he looks at that? In my opinion, these people waited and watched for 40 minutes, waited for us to die. When Tracy and I were carrying our daughter that had a huge edema, you know, down on the street, destroyed streets of Jemaisi in our neighborhood, and looking, watching people on the floor dead, trying to make a way to the first hospital, then to the Red Cross post, then to the next hospital. I had to take my dying daughter on a scooter, and Tracy was with three broken ribs, four broken vertebra, an edema on her face, detached lungs. Had to go on hitchhiking to the hospital.
Paul Naguir recounting what happened 1 year ago in the Port of Beirut explosion. For more, we go to Beirut, Lebanon, to speak with Aya Majoub, the Lebanon and British Bahrain researcher for Human Rights Watch, who co-authored the new report, They Killed Us From the Inside, an investigation into the August 4th Beirut blast. Welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you for joining us from Lebanon, where mass protests broke out yesterday. You were there in the streets. If you can describe the scene there and then put it in the context of the findings of your report, Aya.
Me on today. The protests yesterday were hopeful. They were the biggest protests that we've had in over a year in Lebanon. Thousands of people came out to demand justice and accountability for the Beirut blast. They came from all parts of the country, converging on at the port to hear statements from the families of those who died in the explosion. There was a moment of silence at exactly 6:08 p.m., and then people headed over to Parliament, where there were some skirmishes between security forces who were securing the perimeter of Parliament and protesters who were trying to storm in. Now, Parliament, you know, the seat of Parliament was very significant for protesters yesterday, because the Parliament is currently not lifting immunity that would allow the judicial investigator investigating the Beirut blast to charge and interrogate former ministers and parliamentarians implicated in the Beirut blast. Protesters channeled their anger at the seat of Parliament, and they were met with brute force. The security forces used very large amounts of tear gas. They shot rubber bullets at protesters in violation of international norms. They even shot rubber bullets at least two members of the media who were covering the protests. They used water cannons against protesters. And it's really important to note that the use of force by the security forces was not only aimed at securing the perimeter of Parliament. It seemed to be aimed at ending the protests and dispersing the protesters. They were firing tear gas into crowds containing families, women, and children who were just standing and chanting peacefully. There was absolutely no need for those peaceful protests to be dispersed. It really was quite a show of brute force on a day that was very painful for every Lebanese person, every person who was in the country when the explosion rocked the capital. I don't think there is a single person in Beirut who wasn't in some way impacted by the blast.
And your report, you find in the report, reviewing official documents, doing multiple interviews with top officials, including the president, the caretaker prime minister, the head of the country's state security. Talk about what you found and what you're calling for now.
The findings, I mean, there were rumors since the explosion happened that high-level officials were aware of the ammonium nitrate. But just seeing all of the evidence in one place, seeing how many times these high-level officials were warned not only about the presence of the ammonium nitrate in the port, but the dangers that ammonium nitrate could pose to public safety. We didn't find any Lebanese official who took any responsibility for securing the port and for removing the ammonium nitrate and ensuring that the public was not harmed by the impact of the ammonium nitrate. The levels of corruption and negligence that we found through this documentation was really just shocking. And what was even more shocking was the interviews that we conducted with these high-level officials. There really didn't seem to be any sense of remorse or accountability. Every senior official that we met with was very quick to dismiss the allegations against them, say that they acted within the powers that they had, and just point the fingers at other people. Nobody took responsibility. Nobody apologized. There was such a callousness that came through in these interviews with the high-level officials that I just found very unsettling.
So you're calling for the UN to get involved, to do the investigation?
Yes, we're calling for the Human Rights Council at the United Nations to send an investigative mission to Lebanon to investigate why the ammonium nitrate was in Lebanon in the first place. Who knew about the ammonium nitrate in the port and failed to act? And then what triggered the explosion last year on August the 4th? And the investigative mission should very clearly define what violations the Lebanese state committed against its population, particularly the violation of the right to life. We're also calling for this fact-finding body or investigative mission to propose recommendations to reform the port system and the customs system, the judicial system, to ensure that something like this can never happen again, and that the justice system in Lebanon is better equipped to be able to deal with investigations of this magnitude.
Aya Majoub, I want to thank you for being with us. Lebanon, Bahrain researcher for Human Rights Watch. We'll link to that report, They Killed Us from the Inside, investigation into the August 4th Beirut blast. In 20 seconds, we'll be back to look at the economic collapse in Lebanon. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! As we continue our coverage of Lebanon, we end today's show with Nasreen Salty, economics professor at the American University of Beirut. Mass protests yesterday following the year anniversary of the explosion in the port of Beirut that killed over 200 people, injured thousands, displaced so many hundreds of thousands. Nasreen, we only have a few minutes. Can you talk about the economic collapse we're seeing right now in Beirut, in Lebanon overall?
Sure. In fact, in the context of the port explosion, it's important to note that as gruesome and horrific and traumatic as the explosion was in terms of magnitude and amplitude, it actually fits in with the general trend of negligence and corruption and collapse that we've been experiencing for months, very rapidly before the explosion, and for years, for a few decades, actually. And so what the explosion does in the context of the economic collapse is it just accelerates the downfall. It accelerates the downward spiral. So just on a few basic metrics to compare where we were a year ago, just before the August 4th explosion of 2020, and we were already well into economic crisis, into a few months of economic crisis by then. So the overall price level, for instance, since the explosion is up by 234%. The minimum wage is half of what it was in real dollar terms. Today we have the lowest minimum wage in the world. The hours of electricity supplied by the state company were around 10 to 12 hours per day in the capital a year ago. Today, there are at most 2 hours a day countrywide, and it's becoming increasingly impossible to afford diesel fuel for private generators in order to compensate for the lack of electricity, because the price of diesel fuel on the black market is 18-fold what it was a year ago. The price of a basic food basket has tripled. The price of gasoline for cars has tripled, and it's also very difficult to find. So actually, this economic collapse, which was already underway, what the port explosion has done, instead of being a turning point or a moment of reckoning, has just pushed us further into the abyss of total economic freefall.
We want to thank you so much, Nisreen, for joining us. And Nisreen Salty, economics professor at the American University of Beirut. And you can go to Democracy Now! When we spoke to her last, as she went more deeply into the crisis that Lebanon is facing today. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nameen Sheikh, Marita Arsena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.